2012 ended in tragedy and a wake-up call.
If we can get other students to report the threats, then we can get in there protectively and kind of shrink-wrap the kid who made the threat so that he can get help and so that everyone else can be safe.
What we can learn from school shootings and programs to help troubled kids. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. The shootings at an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut stopped a nation in its tracks, leading us to look again at our gun laws, at our failures in dealing with mental health issues, and maybe, just maybe, preparing us to find answers that prevent a future tragedy. What's shocking is that this was just another in a very long list of horrific school shootings, shootings that have been happening for generations. Rebecca Coffey is a journalist who's investigated the history of school shootings in her book, Murders Most Foul and the School Shooters in Our Midst. Rebecca, all of us are aware this is not the first school shooting, but I was stunned at just how many there have been.
The history of school shootings in America started in 1927. And since then, on campus, on elementary, high school, college and university campuses all told, there have been more than 200 people killed in multi-fatality massacres. Writing up the history of the slaughters in America was difficult because there are so many that when you try to read it, your mind goes dead. That's how many there are.
Did you see any common denominators in the research you did?
Well, the biggest common denominator is that it's usually guys with guns. Only three of the massacres have been perpetrated by girls or women, and only the very first had fatalities caused by anything but guns. Sometimes the perpetrator is an adult from outside the school, as we just saw, but most often it's a member of the student body. And when it's a member of the student body, the FBI has observed that it's a kid exhibiting social withdrawal, feeling isolated, feeling rejected, feeling persecuted, low school interest and poor academic performance. And all those things are important to know, but they also describe a huge number of people who will never, ever in their lives become violent. So it's useless in creating a profile to stop the next violent act because it just describes too many teenagers on too many days of their lives.
So is there any profile that's useful?
No, there's no profile that's useful at all. The FBI has given up the search for a school shooter profile. And instead, what they've said is that most of these people, during the time in which they plan the assault, and usually that's a significant period of time, Columbine, for example, was planned for well over a year. During the planning period, the perpetrator usually tells one or more people what his plans are. 81%. So what the FBI says is that is our opportunity to stop these things from happening again. If we can, as a community, become attuned to these threats, if we can recognize the threats, if we can get other students in the school to report the threats, then we can get in there protectively and kind of shrink-wrap the kid who made the threats so that he can get help and so that everyone else can be safe. But that, to hear, recognize, and intelligently assess the threats is what the FBI suggests everyone do.
At the end of your book, you have a list of tips for families to help keep their kids safe, and that's one of them. What else?
The obvious one is keep guns out of reach of children, right? But by out of reach, you have to keep them way out of reach. The two teenage murderers in Arkansas in the late 90s broke into a gun safe to get their guns. Locking guns up in a gun safe clearly isn't enough. I think we also need to get rid of zero tolerance policies in school, because if I'm a kid and I hear a rumor on a playground, I'm not going to run and tell the school counselor if I think my name is going to be associated with that, and I think that the kids who said something are automatically going to be expelled. Because what if they were kidding? What if I misunderstood the situation? What if I'm an anxious kid and tend to overreact? I'm going to doubt myself. I'm going to keep quiet as long as that zero tolerance policy is in place. I think we need to get rid of them. I think that schools need to guarantee confidentiality to students who report scary things. And I think that parents need to assure their own children that there is a trustworthy system in place for assessing the threats. And the corollary to that is that the parents have to make sure that the schools implement trustworthy confidential systems. One other thing is that everybody has to learn how to assess threats to a certain extent. And what the experts say is that the more explicit the threat is, the more dangerous it is. You know, I've said in my life, I'm so mad I could kill, but I'm never going to kill anybody. But I have never said, I've stolen guns, I'll be up on the hill, don't come to school Monday. If you hear something that specific, it's an emergency. We like to feel that we're safe. And so we tend to look at perpetrators as complete aliens, as totally unlike us. This happens everywhere. It happens in the communities where people don't lock their doors. It happens in the suburbs and the countryside more often than it happens in inner city schools. So this is a threat that we all face. It is coming from within. It's coming from children and adults who know how to fly under the radar. They may have seemed odd, but by and large, they have no criminal record before they act out. So we have to keep our vigilance up, but at the same time, we have to have school environments that feel really safe for a five-year-old, that feel like, oh, you know, let them feel like, oh boy, I'm going to go to school today. So while we understand that everyone is at equal peril here, and we can't shut it out and say this happens to people not like me, we also have to live full lives and create and maintain nurturing school environments where people want to be and they want to learn, because school takes up a huge part of a child's life.
Rebecca Coffey is the author of Murders Most Foul and The School Shooters in Our Midst. Find out more at murdersmostfoul.com. Coming up, police training to help defuse a crisis, a story you won't forget. Plus, a school program that helps troubled kids early. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1225.
And it might be time to love one another. It might be time for you to put your hand in mine. It just might be time. It just might.
Sometimes, when we're lucky, police are able to intervene before a tragedy happens. But it takes training and understanding to de-escalate a crisis. Chicago police officer Julie Joy specializes in these tense situations. Jo Deso of WBEZ explains she's got a special relationship with these kids.
As a 13-year veteran of the Chicago Police Department, Julie Joyce has seen her share of violent kids. Kids who are abusing their parents, or siblings, or others. Kids who appear to be out of control. And at that moment, she realizes that police officers have a decision to make.
If somebody is in danger of hurting themselves or others, then we have to take the proper steps to address that. And I call it talking a person off a ledge. That's how you should kind of talk to them. You know, which side do you want them to go over? Do you want them to fall off the end, or do you want them to come to safety?
She does everything she can to bring them back from that ledge.
I talk about my personal life, and I tell them, I really do understand what you're going through. No, I'm not sick myself. No, I'm, you know, never suffered a psychotic episode, but I know what it looks like, and I know how much you're hurting. And I'm here really to help you. I'm not here to hurt you. So whatever it takes, whatever I can come up with. Sometimes we'll have to stand outside and smoke for a while, or sometimes I have to sit on their couch and talk for a while. And sometimes they'll just stand there and scream in my face and call me all kinds of names. But I think at the end of it, they realize that I'm not leaving, and I haven't yet jumped on them or tackled them or cuffed them. So I think it does build that level of trust a little more.
What Officer Joyce often tells the subject she encounters at work is that she brings personal experience to roll call. She has an 18-year-old son at home named Christopher who suffers from ADHD and bipolar disorder. And he's had a rough time. Early on in his illness, he was wrongly diagnosed and improperly medicated. It was corrected, but soon came adolescence, and with it, hormonal changes that only added to the complications of living with his disorders. Add teen angst to the mix, and it equaled fits of rage.
I always joke about that. I am a professional. I'm a professional spackler. I can fix anything with spackle, Gorilla Glue, and duct tape.
But it wasn't just the mental illness that Joyce and her son were trying to cope with. It was dealing with a system that offers few options when things get bad.
Now, when Christopher was first in the hospital, he's 12 years old. 12-year-old boy who has to be searched, strip searched. He wasn't there for drugs or trying to kill himself. He was there for medication adjustment. They don't tell you what's going on. The only time they call you is, let's say, they called me at 1 in the morning and say, "Hi, Miss Joyce, we had to restrain your son for 15 minutes and 2.5 seconds, and then we shot him up." Taking him to a hospital when he had to go, it killed me. It's like taking your child to jail. You know, like, my kid did nothing wrong, and he would say that. What did I do wrong? And I would say, "You did nothing wrong. We have to get your medication fixed, and I can't help you." And it breaks your heart.
Many families dealing with mental illness refer to the lack of dignity and sensitivity they often face at the hands of figures of authority. Little training or understanding of the complex needs of those living with mental illness can often exacerbate a tense situation. This issue exists in many areas of authority, including police departments. That's why agencies like the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, suggest public safety officers undergo training on how to deal with mentally ill subjects. Suzanne Andrikaitis is the executive director of NAMI of Greater Chicago, and she says that when NAMI first approached the Chicago Police Department, they said,
"Nah, we don't need that."
But the incidents continued, and it became clear to people inside and out of the police department that something needed to be done. So they looked at Crisis Intervention Team Training, or CIT. That's a program devised to teach police officers to de-escalate a situation, improve safety, and provide crisis prevention. It took a few years, but this led to a pilot CIT program within the CPD. And the program was a success by most measures.
In the year and a half, 2 years that they evaluated the pilot program, they documented 465 encounters between CIT-trained officers and individuals in the community who were having a crisis, a mental health crisis. And there were no injuries to the individuals either. So both of those things together convinced the Chicago Police Department that, you know, this was a good program.
By the mid-2000s, with the help of NAMI and others in the community, Chicago established its own Crisis Intervention Team Training Program. And it's since expanded from the several dozen officers that trained in its pilot program to today, where hundreds of officers have received CIT training. CIT officers work hard to prevent mentally ill subjects from ending up in jail. They redirect them to services in the community or hospitals. But it wasn't until a few years after it launched that Officer Joyce heard of the CIT program, and it was a perfect fit. A Marriage of Her Passions, and she jumped on the opportunity. Following her training, Joyce began working with fellow officers who wanted to expand their CIT program into a new area. They worked once again with NAMI and other stakeholders to develop a program for kids and adolescents.
It wasn't just our ideas, it was everybody's ideas. So I think collaboratively, it's an excellent program, I think. And it was also great being the first department in the nation to do it.
They now had an advanced CIT training program for youth. And Officer Julie Joyce even asked to participate on one of the training panels. But she didn't do it alone. She had a partner.
I told my mom I would talk, I would answer any question whatsoever.
We did it together the first time, sink or swim, and it was amazing. He was amazing. He really surprised me.
They asked me things like, how do you react? What are your triggers? How can we as police officers and how can we as crisis workers, how can we react to something like this and how can we help cope with the situation?
The decision to go in front of her fellow officers and reveal so much of her personal life, including talking about her son's mental illness, wasn't an easy one for Joyce. A lot of stigma is attached, but it's worth it. For Christopher, for Officer Joyce, and for her brethren in blue.
One guy was very happy. He came up, he was like, you know what, to be honest, I'm not going to lie, I thought this program was dumb. Came up and he said, thank the Lord I met you.
But that's happened numerous times, I think, hasn't it?
Yeah.
People have thanked him and hugged him and told him how proud they are of him.
Right? Slipped me $20 in the back.
And for Joyce, the rewards of watching her son connect with fellow officers like that meant a whole lot more.
Just seeing that, it's almost like he graduated from Harvard, you know? Like I can only imagine what a parent feels like when their kid graduates from an Ivy League school, but that's kind of how I felt. Like, look at him. Look at him. Because if you would have asked me when he was 5 years old if we would be sitting, you know, here or there or anywhere, I could have told you we wouldn't know what we were doing tomorrow. I mean, I could never fathom that we would come this far and that he would be on this journey with me. By doing the CIT training, he's also speaks more openly, especially around his peers. So now his peers have started to look at him like a role model and reach out to him for help. So it's kind of going full circle.
What was the car ride home like after that first time together?
I just told him how proud I was of him the whole way home. And then he asked me what was to eat. But I also told him, you know, that the one thing that officers would remember was what he said. When they're on the street, they're always going to remember your voice is going to be in their head. Do this, don't do this, try not to do this. That will stay with them for the rest of their career.
Joe Dussault, WBEZ.
A diagnosis of childhood ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is a growing trend, with the Center for Disease Control reporting numbers increasing by more than 5% a year. In 2007, parents reported almost 10% of children under the age of 17 were diagnosed with ADHD. The CDC estimates 1 in 88 children in the U.S. is born with an autism spectrum disorder, anything from mild Asperger's to severe autism. Other statistics estimate that at any time, 1 in 10 children and adolescents is affected by a serious emotional disturbance. Our schools are struggling to meet the needs of all their students, but it's clearly not a one-size-fits-all population. In the rural Onteora School District in New York's Catskills region, there's a program called MAPS, the Management Attention Program Special Class, and it's finding and helping kids early. Cindy Bishop is director of Pupil Personnel Services.
There's one special ed teacher, as many as 8 students, and 2 highly trained teaching assistants all the time in the program with the students and the teacher. In addition to those folks in the program, we also have a social worker that's tied very closely to the program, and we have a behavior intervention assistant, which is a TA that's highly trained in behavioral interventions. The program is currently running for intermediate age students, so 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th. And some of the students are mainstreamed for their core curriculum, and do very well. So it really meets the needs of a wide range of students and with a wide range of needs.
And talk to me about what those needs might be.
Well, some of the students may be classified with autism. Some of the students may be classified with emotional disabilities. You know, some students just have the need to learn coping skills to be able to mainstream back out into the general education population in the school. By seventh grade, they are, you know, typically they're ready to go to the middle school. They're ready to move into the mainstream classes. In very few cases, we do have to seek an out-of-district placement for a student, but, you know, like I said, it is highly successful. The teachers and the TAs have been working together for many years. It's more of a clinical model. They do get together weekly for clinical reviews of students and, you know, really supportive.
And what do you do that helps them to learn that control?
You know, intensive counseling, intensive teaching new strategies to just to support themselves as learners and as active participants in a classroom, modeling appropriate behaviors.
And I'm assuming that people would think this costs the district money, but I'm going to guess there's a savings here because of the lack of the need for services later once they're mainstreamed.
Sure. There's an immediate savings to the district, and then there's a long-term saving to the district. Because if a student is really struggling in a general education setting, even with the support of a special education teacher, you know, you can only lay on so many layers of support in the public school. So what happens many times is we do have to seek an out-of-district placement. But because of a program like this, you know, there's an expense to the district when you first start a program like this, but the long-term savings is significant. You know, you keep the kids in the district. You don't have to transport them to costly private settings, which may or may not be better than a district-provided program. You know, here in the district, we have access to them. We want to keep them. We want to do everything we can to support them.
And are you seeing more children needing this program? Is it a pretty steady line of the number of kids that seem to need these services?
Yeah, I think there is a steady line of students that need these types of services. You know, I've been in education for a long time, and I think that as life changes for all of us, adults and children alike, the stresses of home life and you know, the economy and things like that, I think it affects all of us, including children. So that students that have a difficulty with their emotions and difficulty with their behaviors are going to tend to require the support in school because many times they don't have access to those supports outside of school.
And I'm assuming you think there's a great benefit in helping the younger students.
Absolutely. You know, I don't think there's any better time to learn than the present. And so if we can support them with their, you know, coping strategies, learning all the strategies needed to go ahead and be back in the general ed classroom, then the sooner the better.
Cindy Bishop is Director of Pupil Personnel Services at the Onteora School District in Ulster County, New York. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.